And welcome to the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM, I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Conlon is away. He has scored some tickets, and he's in the upper deck of the Blue Jay Stadium, I understand. So we have a correspondent there, and next week we'll have an update on the run to the championship by the Blue Jays. At the current rate they're going, they will knock down all the walls around the league with the power they're showing. We're going to talk to Eve Engler today. Eve Engler is the author of a terrific book, a brand new book is just out. It's called Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. I'm going to ask him where the aid comes in. I haven't noticed any. But we will be speaking to him. And then later in the show, we're going to continue a conversation we had with author Fred Jerome. He's the author of the book Einstein on Israel, Zionism in Israel. And he has a lot to say about the beginning of this dispute over one state, two state, and whose state, we could say. And that will be a conversation with Fred Jerome, and that will be the latter part of the program. And along the way, I want to make sure we ask Eve Engler about his speaking dates, and I think he's on the line right now. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Hey, thanks very much, Eve. Let's just settle this. You're coming to Toronto, right? We're going to be seeing you here.
I should be there on September 20th.
So September the 20th, and I think that's Betsatoon?
Yes.
Okay, and you're also speaking in Hamilton. Do you know the date and the place you're going to be?
The night before, on September 19th. 7 p.m. and the downtown church.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm hoping you get big attendance. I hope people buy this book, Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. And the way I know that this is an important book is that I filled my little notebook with questions and information that I did not know about. And so I congratulate you. This book seems to be, this looks like a lot of work, this book.
It was definitely a lot of work. I've been researching Canadian foreign policy for a while, and I was taken aback by how much I was unaware of in all kinds of areas that were.
Yeah, well,
Phil, are you hearing weird background noise?
Yeah, we're hearing a bit of it too. Perhaps we could. Let's make a second call to you. I'll talk about the book and with tickets. Make sure to see if we can get a better connection.
Great. Well,
thank you. We're going to be talking to Eve Engler, and it is important. I want to make sure we get clear because a line, if we can, because. Eve has a lot of importance. We're going to ask him about such things as Canada's role in the overthrow and death of Patrice Lumumba, which to my mind is one of the shocking moments that just really set back the struggle for independence and equality for nations when Patrice Lumumba was killed. And there's a lot of information in this new book by Eve Engler, Canada in Africa, 300 Years. And as well, he has information, of course, on Canada in Somalia, which we need to remember. Are you there, Eve?
Hey, Phil.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I was just saying, there's one issue. We'll start with the first part. Canada is part of the British Empire. As I read your book, very snug in the empire, very much a part of every crime, if we're going to call them crimes, committed by the British when they went about becoming the world's most dominant power, and including slavery. Could you let's touch on that? If you could say what you found.
Yeah. Well, basically, there's a. I'm actually still hearing a bit of the background, but I think it's probably okay. There's a whole history of Canada being tied into supporting the transatlantic slave trade, and that goes most importantly probably to the wealth that was created in the Maritimes and Atlantic provinces in Newfoundland in terms of selling cod and other goods to the Caribbean slave plantations, the cod being the food that was given to slaves to keep them going when the plantation owners didn't want to take any land away from producing sugar, and they got the refuse, the cheap refuse cod from Atlantic Canada to feed the slaves. And then there was Canadians that participated in the British attempt to suppress the Haitian uprising, the slave revolution of 1791 to 1804. And there were, of course, African slaves in Canada. So there was this sizable contribution and to upholding slavery and a number of significant Canadian capitalists in Halifax made most of their wealth from selling cod and other goods down to the plantation economies and in some cases selling slaves. So there is this history, and of course the transatlantic slave trade has played a devastating role in African impoverishment and dividing.
Your analysis, you indicate that right into now to the 21st century, that this is the impact of the loss of human beings to Africa and the destruction of their societies has to this day made it difficult for them to advance. And to, but you know, a detail you brought out, I got to, just while we're on that point about the role of Halifax and that region for producing ships and also cod. Cod is such a big story in Canada. It's also a big story in the West Indies where the slaves were, that they were producing, they were bringing in fish to feed the slaves. And, of course, depending upon the profits, they would provide the worst slaves. They calculated just how much nutrition they needed to keep them in the field for 16 hours a day. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, and the there's a quote that I pull from Harold Innes, sorry, the famous Canadian economist, quoting somebody in the House of Commons, talking about just how the refuse fish, the worst of the fish that was could even make the slaves ill in some cases, was being sent down to the Caribbean, and there was a whole sort of economic calculation of, you know, as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, just a small part of a larger inhumanity of the whole transatlantic slave trade and the Caribbean plantation system.
Another matter, I think you are very good at interrupting the great Canadian narrative about basically the good guys in the capitalist camp who always tried to do good and never meant any harm and was always a kind of an open space for oppressed people. But you also provide details that those slaves that were here in Upper Canada and Lower Canada, some of them escaped into Vermont, because Vermont didn't have slaves, and into Michigan, which that really interrupts the great narrative.
Yeah, well, the idea, of course, is that the Underground Railroad brought U.S. slaves to Canada, and then it's, you know, part of the sort of ideology of benevolent Canada, and there were, I don't know exact number, but I think into the hundreds of slaves that made the trek the other way for a period in the late 1700s and early 1800s, when slavery was still practiced here and had been abolished in parts of current day U.S.
Yeah, that It's very important detail, I believe, the way you go at subjects of not accepting. And indeed, that's one of your premises, is it not? You point out that there's a kind of storyline that exists from beginning to end, which is actually false, and that we ought to be fighting not only against the treatment of Africans. But you single out our intelligentsia, the North American, particularly Canadian intelligentsia, in providing a false narrative.
It's so deeply held and so widespread that it something as simple as Canada's complicity with colonialism, which is, anyone who takes a look at it, abundantly clear that Ottawa, number of Canadian companies, the Canadian military at different points, was complicit with 7-8 decades of European rule in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's basically not mentioned. It's just, you just don't talk about it. You just sort of avoid the discussion. And there's chapters and books that sort of deal with components of this, but just never stated explicitly that, in fact, the both de facto and actual policy of Ottawa was to support British rule in Africa, and so it's the starting premise always has to be Canada the good. You can then provide some criticism from that starting premise, but that has to be the starting premise. It seems like if you want to survive in official Canadian foreign policy academia and, of course, corporate media. Mm-hmm. So it's deeply held, but the history is pretty strongly against.
Well, you bring all kinds of evidence this concept, the inevitable one of European supremacy and the notion of the advanced white culture, civilization, which gave it a responsibility to either control or raise, patronize Africans. And you quote a number of people who talk about the Africans from the beginning of the account until now, who use very explicitly at one stage racial terms. Their concept was, I guess they were thinking, it was sort of like, are they educable or are we going to just have to control them? But that was the only two choices, right?
For sure. And for me, right in terms of writing this book, possibly the most surprising chapter or sector of research was the missionaries. And I had a little bit of understanding that there were Canadians who were involved in the scramble for Africa who had helped conquer different parts of the continent for the British. And there's many examples of that which I provide. But the whole world of Canadian missionaries and their role in providing a sort of ideological construct of Christianizing the heathens, the backwards Africans, and they would use those terms pretty openly, was totally startling. And that goes back to the late 1800s. The biggest interdenominational mission across the continent was set up by some missionaries in Toronto, the Sudan Interior Mission, which had this anti-nationalist, quite frankly, racist ideology underpinning it, quite fundamentalist in their interpretation of the Bible, and that continues to have serious legacies or serious consequence on Nigeria, where the country they were primarily involved in, but throughout the continent.
Mm-hmm. And in the establishment of the colonies, particularly, I was very taken with your account of what happened in today's Kenya, and then in what is now, well, what is, was set up as Rhodesia. I mean, you really detailed the theft. I mean, just the taking over and the providing of thousands of acres of rich soil and minerals and whatnot to individuals, sometimes families, and just go in and take it. And Canada thought that was a wonderful thing.
Well,
I should say Canadian leaders.
A Canadian missionary that exchanged health services to Cecil Rhodes' conquering forces in current-day Zimbabwe in exchange for a large chunk of land in Harare was very surprising. A detail, the fact that there was a Canadian governor of Kenya who oversaw incredible dispossession of the Maasai and handing a whole lot of land over to European settlers and in some cases Canadians who were part of the settlement to the community. There's the pillage, the dispossession through force of arms and just explicit might make right kind of ideology was, and unfortunately to a large extent still is, the determining ideology or way things are organized.
Yeah, Eve, isn't one of what we've inherited from this? Isn't this? Haven't we had a problem of people's leaders today saying they want to help, but not revisiting the original crime and the original mistreatment, and which would carry with it, by the way, some financial duty if we were to think about it properly. Instead, it's always, well, we want to start tomorrow and do the right thing. They don't want to revisit what you have revisited in the book Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. This is Eve Engler's, of course. But because following on that, what you outlined, what happened with Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, then they begin with this business that, well, we're going to decolonize or we're going to end colonization, but then they end up, Canada got involved in the overthrow and death of Patrice Lumumba and of Kwame Nkrumah. And I'm really interested in your great account of what happened to Patrice Lumumba. If you would talk about that, you have Dag Hammarskjöld, and you really informed me on that. I had not gotten a clear picture what a low role he played, but neither did I know how active and involved the Canadians were. If you could talk about that business.
Yeah, I mean, today Canadian officials like to lecture the Congolese about democracy and with complete lack of recognition of the far and away the most undemocratic and damaging policy of the post-independence Congo was the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. Canadians were a big part of the UN force that was responsible for, or heavily responsible for, the assassination. The Canadian military head on the mission decades later openly boasted that he, when Lumumba escaped house arrest from under Mobutu's forces,
Was it a Canadian who who located him, told people where he was?
Exactly, it was a Canadian who told Mobutu where Lumumba was, so Mobutu's forces could re-encapture Lumumba and very soon after ultimately assassinate him. So there's all kinds of internal evidence showing the position of the Diefenbaker government, which was very hostile to Lumumba, supportive of Belgium's position, which was Belgium's position basically was, okay, you can have independence, but we'll keep all your resources. And when Lumumba tried to, you know, take decolonization seriously, that was not considered part part of the deal by Brussels and Washington, and Canada participated in that. And I think that it's something that needs to be recognized and apologized for. And in fact, I think there should be Belgium at least had a foreign affairs committee that investigated their role in Lumumba's assassination. And I think that the Canadian Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs should do the same, because the toll on Congolese
Eve, that you really raise an excellent point. We have a somnambulant parliament. Belgium actually revisited the events of Congo, Zaire, Congo, and admitted that they had brought about the death, or certainly actively participated in the assassination of an elected leader. And you could say at least they've done that much. There is some public record, and people had to sit in front of a committee and answer questions. They did the same, actually, Belgium did the same with Rwanda. But Canada played a big role in both places, and there's never been an inquiry.
And there's not even, it's not even on the political agenda of an inquiry. And actually a piece that I'm just in the process of writing, Romeo Dallaire, who Unifor, the largest private sector union in Canada, invited Romeo Dallaire to speak a few days ago at a convention. And it seems a little odd to me that a labor union would be inviting a former general. And we all, of course, know that the reason they invited him was not because he was a general in the Canadian military, but because he now represents part of a myth about Canada's role in the world that is directly tied to events in 1994 in Rwanda.
And the new humanitarian intervention.
And the whole ideology of responsibility to protect. And the other side that about what Romeo Dallaire participated in or did in Rwanda has been completely ignored in the dominant media. And one of the things that I put in the intro is I did a Canadian newsstand search on mentions of Romeo Dallaire's book, and mentions of the book Le Patron de Dallaire Parle, The Boss of Dallaire Speaks, which was by Jacques-Roger Boubou, a former foreign minister of Cameroon, who was the overall commander of the UN mission in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Romeo Dallaire's book, there's more than 1,700 mentions in Canadian newsstands. In the case of Le Patron de Dallaire Parle, there's only 3 mentions, one of them completely dismissive. Only one of them that you could argue was actually sort of sympathetic or reflective of the book. And I think that that's a discussion, a debate that needs to be aired, exactly what Romeo Dallaire was part of and what Canada has supported with regards to the rise of Kagame, the mass killing of 1994, and of course the mass killing in the Eastern Congo, which Canada's had.
And that's another theme of your book. I mean, this is all, you know, we speak of genocides, we speak of massacres, wars, but at the end of the day, Rwanda is controlling East Congo, which is rather rich, and there's a lot of companies, Canadian mining companies and others in there, who are not losing any money during all this.
And in many cases, benefiting from it. But there's basically a century of Canadian participation in the looting of the east of the Congo, going back to William Stinnes, who conquered that part of the Congo for King Leopold, right up until today with Banro, taking resources and working with pro Kagame forces. That's obviously an example of first quantum that had Canadian diplomacy and aid used when it ran into troubles with the central government in the Congo, and the Canadian government, the Harper government, was willing to block debt forgiveness for the Congo debt that was largely accrued during the Mobutu dictatorship. So the orientation of Canadian policy towards the Congo, towards Rwanda, to slightly different dynamic, is heavily oriented around what do the Canadian mining companies want.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Eve Engler, who's coming to Toronto on it's September 20, right, at Betsatoon?
Yes.
Yeah, and the book is Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. The only quibble I have is I didn't see any aid. When I read this book, I say to myself, there's no aid going on here. But I want to ask you about to address something which we hear every time we discuss Africa, and whenever anybody writes an editorial for the Globe or the Star, and that is corruption. And it's always, frankly, I have to say, I believe it's racist. The attitude is, well, they're Africans, so they must be stealing. But you say maybe we've got it upside down. Could you talk about who's being corrupt in Africa?
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of Canadian companies, which I detail on the public record, of Canadian companies paying off officials engaged in what is widely seen as corruption. There's also a history of Ottawa being very indifferent to Canadian corporate corruption abroad, and refusing to make moves to curtail companies' ability to do that. And until into the 90s, it was actually, you could write it off, it was tax deductible to pay off.
You document that. It's in your book to show that they put it on their tax. They deducted their bribe money.
And officials from SNC-Lavalin publicly boasted about it. Which tells you a little bit about where SNC-Lavalin is today with their huge corruption scandal.
Well, that's like an encounter between a John and a prostitute. Why is she the criminal and he goes home?
Exactly.
I mean, he offered money to get something in Africa, why is it that the African who took the money is corrupt, but the guy who offered it to him is not corrupt?
It's part of the colonial double standard that's long-standing and deeply held.
Yeah.
But beyond that, those sort of kind of obvious of what would be widely perceived as corruption, which is, payoff to officials and the like, Africa or African countries lose a whole lot more from the loss of tax payments by corporations, multinational corporations, which use a variety of means to lessen their tax bill that are possibly legal, but certainly immoral, and in many cases illegal, and often called transfer pricing. And Canadian corporations have a particularly big role in this whole process, partly because a number of the tax havens in the Caribbean, they were largely set up as tax havens by Canadian officials. And there's a very good book about this by Alain Deneau, that just came out a few months ago. He goes into it, the history quite impressively. And so there's transfer pricing and the loss of tax payments, tax avoidance, leads to tens and tens of billions of dollars of lost money to African governments, and that leads to less money, of course, for healthcare or education or whatnot. So the focus tends to be on the sort of what's narrowly conceived as corruption, and even on that front, there's often direct multinational or Canadian involvement in that. But to just look at the narrow is mistaken, because I think that the broader, the whole structural process of how corporations avoid their taxes and the different mechanisms that the Canadian government has been involved with in enabling that is a much greater consequence to impoverishment and different countries' African countries' ability to improve their economic position.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, Great to talk to you. The book is Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, on the shelves now with Eve Engler. You're going to be here on the 20th at Beth Satoun at, I assume, 7 o'clock in the evening. Maybe we could get you, when you're here, to come into the studio, and that way we'll have a better sound. We apologize for our difficulties today, but I really believe this is a very important book, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll get up. Eve Engler, and you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And we're going to spend more time on the Engler book because it is very well researched, full of details and footnotes, and it will set you to wanting to read not only the Engler account, but some of his sources. And he is a master researcher.